Don't waste time on emotions that don't do you any good.
Do I call you Lady Justice?
You can just call me Justice. Well, you tell me what a sandwich is, and then I'll tell you if a hot dog is a sandwich. When will there be enough women on the court? And my answer is, when there are nine. The two people love each other, and both are women or both are men. Why should the law put up a no sign?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, Andrew. It's episode 440, Opening Arguments, A440. Oh, music joke. How's it going? It's Opening Arguments. It's episode 440. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How you doing?
Was that a 4-4 time joke?
No, A440 is used for tuning. It's a reference note for tuning. But not all music is based on 440. I guess it would be hertz, right? Yeah. Sometimes people tune a little differently. They'll tune A to, you know, something a little lower, a little higher. But A440, if you're tuning your guitar while listening, it's something like that. Okay. Anyway, how are you doing, Mr. Fantastic?
Well, I learned something here today, Thomas.
So. No, that's what the show's for.
So I'm doing even better than Fantastic.
I'm not sure how I'm doing until you explain what's happening. That's been true many weeks. I assume Trump's still trying to steal the election. I think they're like, technically they're like 1-for-30 or something on the lawsuits. And I actually don't remember what the one is. I want to know. That's going to be my first question. But we got more legal shenanigans to cover. But also, I'm excited because we have the one and only Morgan Stringer, who we were already busy, by the way. Patrons will already know this. Busy recording a, you know, almost 2-hour Lot Awful Movies on the plot against the president, which was fantastic. Go to patreon.com/law, check it out. We break down the absolute monstrosity that is the plot against the president. Devin Nunes's, just to give you a little preview, it's a documentary that tries to make Devin Nunes out to be some like secret badass genius. And that's
it is a documentary that shoots Devin Nunes all but, you know, planting the flag at Iwo Jima, right? Like it is.
Well, there's a lot of walking down staircases. Oh, there's God. A lot of just things like, what can we do to make him look like a, I don't know, like a congressperson? Yep. And they're like, I'm as lost as you are, director. I'm just a cinematographer over here. I don't know. How could we possibly make this guy look like a congressman? I bring this up because we were, we were busy doing that for hours and hours of stupidity. But fortunately, we have one expert, Morgan Stringer, to listen to Rudy Giuliani so that none of us have to. we're gonna have her come on to give us the greatest hits later. I can't wait for that. Been seeing a lot of memes of Charlie Day being Giuliani. Those have been funny. Quick announcement before we get going.
That's right, Thomas. We are getting together with our friends in podcasting with a bunch of great podcasters to head on over to the Cognitive Dissonance live stream. This is going to be on Black Friday. That is Friday, November 27th, right? So instead of...
Yeah, I was going to say, I know what you'll all be not doing, which is going out to a place to go shopping, I hope.
Yeah. Stay home, and at 4 p.m., we are the leadoff hitter, right? What Sabermetrics tells us is the most important spot in the lineup. So 4 p.m. Eastern time, 1 p.m. Pacific, you can figure out your time. You're going to head on over to twitch.tv/dissonancepod, and we are part of a 3-hour fundraiser for the Georgia Democratic runoff candidates, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff. And it's going to be a great time. Like we're doing it. Seth Andrews, the How to Heretic guys, all of the folks over from Puzzle and a Thunderstorm, the people you've come to expect. And what we are doing is encouraging donations to Act Blue to fund the Georgia Democratic runoff. So here's the real thing, and I've got to make this plea to all of our listeners. 100% this will be competitive, right? Like, if we lose out and the scathing guys like raise more money for Warnock and Ossoff than we do, like, we will never ever live that down. So show up to the live stream. We have multiple donors who have lined up to make matching contributions. And this is a way, right? Like, everybody says, well, I listen to Opening Arguments, like, you know, you keep me sane, but you also report on, you know, terrible stuff. Well, you know, if you wondered if there's something you can do, this is literally the easiest thing you could do. You could listen to bonus episodes of this and other fantastic shows. It's going to be funny. It's going to be uncensored and raise money for Warnock and Ossoff to take back the Senate. So,
it's so Friday. Important. It's so important. I'm glad they're doing that. That's going to be a lot of fun. And yeah, we'll be first up. So I think that the sabermetrics tells us if the elections don't go well, I think we're to blame. I'm not ready for that kind of.
Don't
let it happen, everybody. Come donate. Yeah. Come watch and donate.
Down. 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 Down.
All right, Andrew, I have ascertained that Biden won the election, but apparently it's more complicated for some people to do some ascertainment than that. So why don't you tell us all about ascertainment?
Yeah, so I would not have thought that I would be doing a 15-minute segment on my show about the definition of ascertainment pursuant to the Presidential Transition Act of 1963. But, you know, here we are. So many of you have been following this story, and I want to break down what it means and, of course, the massive Republican hypocrisy on this issue, because it's a political issue. So therefore, there is massive Republican hypocrisy. What's going on? GSA Administrator Emily Murphy is basically the Kim Davis of this election. She is required to ascertain that Joe Biden is president-elect of the United States, because he is. And pursuant to the Presidential Transition Act of 1963, she is authorized to release information and funds to the Biden transition team. And the reason you might be asking, I'm going to explain that the law is crystal clear. You might be asking, okay, well, if it's so clear, why haven't there been lawsuits yet? I think there are really two answers to that. The first is the law is crystal clear, but I don't know how much of an enforcement mechanism it has. I'm going to explain that in a second.
Great. And so it's clear as Kushner kind
point,
of thing?
Yeah, right. And the second point is I do think, right, that there is we're stuck – I think this is the last week of it, as we're going to go into in more detail on Tuesday's show. But we're stuck in this kind of limbo in which the Biden incoming administration is rolling their eyes, but not ready to go to court yet over the dominant narrative of, well, we just have to give President Trump enough time to get over the fact that he lost. I think they are thinking that Murphy will ascertain the results of the election next week, and therefore that will obviate the need for them to have to bring a lawsuit seeking a declaratory judgment and injunction requiring her to do that. So what does it mean to ascertain an election? As it turns out, this means a common sense judgment. Right? So the Presidential Transition Act of 1963 is super weird. And by the super weird, here's what I mean by that. Usually, I will read the common title of an act, and then, as a lawyer, I will tell you what section of the U.S. Code you can go to find the act. And here, the answer is you go to 3 U.S.C. Section 102. I will link that in the show notes. But the problem is, when you type in 3 U.S.C. 102, or you click on the link in the show notes, you go there, you will see a two-line provision that says the president gets a $400,000 a year salary. You will see nothing about the Presidential Transition Act of 1963 and all of the provisions that I'm about to talk to you about. In order to find it, you have to click on the editorial notes section.
Wow.
And let me explain that for a second. Notes in the annotated U.S. code are meant to be interpretive guidance, right? So a statute might say you are required expeditiously to mail out ballots to voters. And then in the notes, it might say this provision was amended in 1997 and replaced and added the word expeditiously after X thing happened. And it took, you know, 5 weeks for ballots to go out to voters and presumptively is meant to say we shouldn't delay by 5 weeks, right? And so if you go to court over that particular statute, the note isn't technically part of the law, but is interpretive guidance. I've never, ever seen this. Again, I'm not an administrative lawyer. I know we have some who listen to the show, so I invite your commentary. I have never seen an entire act contained only in the interpretive notes section.
So wait, who wrote those interpretive notes? Could anybody, like the custodian, just come in there and like write some, scribble some stuff in the margins?
There are two processes for this, right? The first is that the notes are compiled by the West Company, right? That puts the books together. But the second is that a law can
specify. You're saying this is like C3 USC sticky note to.
Yeah, it kind of is like that, right?
Weird.
And so all of the enforcement mechanisms, and I use that with scare quotes, are framed in terms of what the Presidential Transition Act of 1963 says, which is, accordingly, it is the intent of the Congress that appropriate actions be authorized and taken to avoid or minimize any disruption in the transfer power from the outgoing administration to the incoming administration. So all of the things I'm about to tell you about, that's how they're set forth. And they're set forth in Section 3A, and there are 10 different things that this Transition Act is meant to provide to a campaign. Office space, payment of staff, payment of expenses for experts, payment of travel expenses, communication services, printing and binding, postage, briefings and workshops, and that's a really important aspect, as you might imagine. The preparation of a transition directory, right? That is saying, hey, don't call Karen over in accounting anymore. You want to call, you know, Bob, who's coming in. And finally, human resources and various software. It also provides for transmitting certain non-public information because you've brought in and your transition people are now technically government employees, right? During the span of the transition, that they occupy a little bit of a gray area. And I'm not going to go into, you know, whether they get paid and all of that. That's covered by the transition funds. And there are some wrinkles that you don't really care about. But none of that has happened. And the reason that none of that has happened is because Emily Murphy has not ascertained that Joe Biden is the president-elect. So the question is, what does it mean to do that, and should she have? And the answer is, subsection 3C says the terms president-elect and vice-president-elect, as used in this act, shall mean such persons as are the apparent successful candidates for the office of president and vice president, respectively, as ascertained by the administrator. That's why it's called ascertainment, right? Then you might say, okay, well, what does it mean to be the apparent successful candidates? And the answer is, that's not defined, right? The answer is, use your common sense. Like, we can't define every word in every law, right? Like, apparent successful candidate. In 1963, when they passed this act, having had, by the way, a very, very close election between Kennedy and Nixon in 1960, right? You still knew what it meant to be an apparently successful candidate, which, by the way, 100% is what Joe Biden is. How do I know this? Because of Todd Zwicky.
Oh, I know it just because he won and it was in the
well,
news.
Yes. But
so Todd Zwicky told you?
Todd Zwicky told me. Well, he didn't quite tell me. What he did was wrote perhaps the angriest law review article I have ever seen. I mean that sincerely, right? Like, as somebody who writes rather angry law review and other articles, and does a rather angry show sometime. But in 2001, he wrote an article for the BYU Law Review called The Law of Presidential Transitions. And that argued in 2000 that the then Clinton appointee as the GSA administrator violated the law by failing to ascertain that George W. Bush was president until December 14th, right, which was after, right, the day after, immediately after Bush v. Gore came out,
right,
and Gore conceded to Bush, right?
So like, you mean when it was clear who won, basically?
Right, when it was clear who won, right?
Okay.
This is, Zwicky said,
so this person did their job, really.
Yeah, you had a requirement to do that much, much earlier. And the reason you had a duty to do that much, much earlier is because apparent winner of the election does not mean you have to wait until the other party concedes. It does not mean you have to wait until all of the legal battles are exhausted. It means you use your judgment. You say, who's likely to win the election? Or, in Zwicky's words, who has a majority of the pledged plus certified electoral votes? And when that is a number over 270, when one person has a majority, as George W. Bush had on November 26th, 2000, then you are required to ascertain that they are the president under the Presidential Transition Act of 1963.
Okay, but that's wrong. I mean, there was a court case. I mean, had Bush v. Gore gone the other way, maybe, it's a 500-vote margin in Florida, you can't actually ascertain with certainty who won until you know what's happening with those butterfly ballots or whatever, just hanging chats.
I'm glad you have raised that argument. There is an entire section in the Law of Presidential Transitions.
Oh, great. Another sticky note. I just found it. Hold on. Let me peel this off. See what it says.
That makes two arguments. The first argument that responds to that is there's no problem if you certify an apparent winner and that person later turns out not to be the winner.
Right.
The plain language of the act requires the administration, quote, clearly limits the administration's discretion in naming the president-elect and cannot be circumvented simply because you think that that person might have the results overturned by a later court case. Again, let me quote from Zwicky. By using the term apparent, Congress recognized the possibility that some contingency might intervene that caused a situation where the apparent winning candidate did not, in fact, turn out to be the actual winning candidate. This could be for any number of reasons, including the death of the president-elect during the transition period, electoral fraud overturning an election, resignation of a candidate, ballot recounts that change the result after the initial general election, or a faithless elector who violates his pledge and votes for a candidate different from the one for whom he promised to vote. The drafters of the act specifically considered the possibility that faithless electors and the fact that faithless electors could upset the final recognition of the apparent winner as the actual winner. Acknowledging this was a possibility, the drafters nonetheless agreed that this possibility would not provide a basis for refusing to recognize the pledged electors in ascertaining an apparent winner. Any of these contingencies could occur, and in fact, have actually occurred, but there's no reason to believe that the possibility they might arise again should interfere with making the designation of an apparent successful candidate when one can be identified. And I would add, in response to the ambiguity that was created in 2000, Congress amended the act in response to this confusion, which, look, I'm making the strongest counter argument, right? Like I certainly think that the activity there was undertaken in good faith and was reasonable, right? But nevertheless, backing up this argument, right, is the idea that Congress in 2001 amended the Presidential Transition Act of 1963. And what they did was they added a subsection H. And that subsection H says, added in addition to president-elect and vice president-elect, added a section for eligible candidates, right? So in other words, in the event that you can't ascertain who the president is, but you can ascertain who might be the president, there's another provision whereby you can then authorize some of the transition to eligible candidates. And you could authorize it to both people, right? Like the only person who is prohibited from receiving funds under the Presidential Transition Act is, of course, the incumbent president, because there's nothing to transition to the incumbent president. So it is manifestly clear to me that Zwicky was correct in 2001, right? When you read this statute, the point of the statute is to err in favor of a smooth transition from the outgoing administration to the incoming administration. You don't have to wait for the outgoing administration to concede. You don't have to wait for all the recounts to be over. You don't have to wait for all of the legal battles to be over. It's not a problem, right? This is, we're talking $10 million, which admittedly, like, I'd like $10 million. But as a function of the federal government, right, that's couch cushion money, right? In the event that you erroneously certify the wrong president, what's the worst that can happen? And the worst that could happen is the act, by the way, provides that the new people that you bring in, you have to prepare a memorandum of understanding. They have to sign non-disclosure agreements if they're getting non-public information, right? Like they have to abide by the law. Like the worst that would happen is, oh, a bunch of people who we thought were going to have jobs in the next administration, turns out they don't have those jobs. And, you know, they can't go around. They can't sell those secrets to the Russians or whatever. And all right, we spent an extra couple $1 million on office space and postage for people who, as it turns out, are not going to occupy the White House. And that the framers, bipartisan, right, in Congress on multiple occasions have said, yeah, we'd rather spend an extra couple $1 million and maybe a crazy contingency means we flush that down the toilet than have a situation like the one we have now, in which the incoming administration is being deliberately hamstrung, right? They are being kneecapped right here by not being provided information, office space, and ability to bring in their own people to start the hard work of rebuilding this government from the inside. There is no basis, and hopefully...
It's truly disgusting. I mean, come on with this. It's so much of it is, too, is all the Republicans are like, well, we just want to let him kind of come to the conclusion. No! Come on! He lost!
The law says you don't get a, like, you know, five stages of Kubler-Ross grief of the outgoing. The law says as soon as you know who the apparent winner is, then you should begin the ascertainment process. And that begins, right? That can begin as early as election night, right?
Yeah.
2012, we knew who the winner was on who the apparent winner was on election night. Now here, right, if Emily Murphy had taken until Saturday, until Fox News said, you know, in 900-point font, Joe Biden is apparently president-elect, right? Like, that's all we're saying, right? Use ordinary judgment, take a look, and see who is likely to win a majority of the actual, right, pledged and certified electoral votes. That answer is Joe Biden. The law is clear. She is required to ascertain that and to begin the turnover process. And I think you will see legal action next week if she hasn't by then.
I just picture an exasperated kindergarten teacher pointing a stick at a board that says Biden 306, Trump 232, So who won? I don't know. God! I can't tell which number's bigger than the other. I don't know. I don't understand.
Joe Biden will become the 46th president of the United States.
This election is not over.
It's over, beast!
This is a major fraud in our nation.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win.
You lose!
It's over, beast!
What's happening with these lawsuits? Should I be at all worried? There was some talk of, you know, Michigan, they're not, people not certifying them, and then they were certifying them. There's also a really nice rant by somebody that Teresa posted that was pretty amazing, dressing down these Michigan people who were refusing to certify these election results. What's happening, Andrew?
The answer is Donald Trump has confirmed in his legal filings today that all of this is a pretextual sham. And I'm going to prove that to you using his own words in his own filings. I'm going to make this crystal clear. The analogy I used when I went on the Daily Beans earlier this week, and I know I really did this for you, Thomas, because I know how much our listeners love when we use football analogies. But this is the way to think about this election. It's a football game. Joe Biden has 21 points. Donald Trump has 3. And as time elapses, he tries to kick a field goal. Okay. The field goal is wide right.
Mm-hmm.
Trump throws the flag. And as you're looking at it, you're saying, well, that seems like a really stupid challenge flag because, you know, you kicked it. It was wide
time
right by
expiring.
15 yards.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then you would say, as a football fan, but who the hell cares?
Yeah.
Right. You want to lose 21-6? Great. Like, are you trying to cover a 17-point spread? Like, what's going on?
Well, I think I made that joke last week where I was like, you know what? Have some more votes. We'll give you just 10,000 votes. There you go. What's that? It didn't do anything? Gosh.
So
wasting the court's time with this nonsense.
So that's right. So remember, Joe Biden has 306 pledged and certified electoral votes. And we're going to talk next week about the distinction between those two. That means you must invalidate 37 of those votes to make a difference. The Trump campaign has lawsuits active in 2 states right now, Pennsylvania and Michigan. Pennsylvania plus Michigan added together have 36 electoral votes. In other words, you could take the entirety of their nonsense lawsuits. And by the way, I'm about to explain that they are nonsense, and subtract 36 from 306 and you get 270, which, you know, like,
oh, that still
it's
wins
super
you the election.
Close,
yeah.
But that's still, you still win the election. No one cares, right? Like, you win game 7 of the World Series 2-1, to mix a sports metaphor. No one is like, oh, well, you're just barely the World Series champion. No, like, you won. And
well, I will say, though, that would really scare me if it was that close because of the weird faithless elector stuff.
That should scare you, right? But here's what shouldn't scare you. I have said that there are, right, Pennsylvania has 20 electoral votes, Michigan has 16 electoral votes. I have said that there are lawsuits in both of those states. Kind of not now. And this relates to the Michigan lawsuits. So let's start with that, because this is something that broke late last night, developed this morning, and I think most media outlets do not understand the significance of what happened in Michigan. So there is a pending state court case that is Trump versus Jocelyn Benson. That is in state court. The relief that they were seeking had to do with stopping the counting of absentee ballots. Okay. Had nothing to do with certifying the results. And this is the complaint. I know a lot got kind of lost, but you may have seen media reports about how the Trump campaign filed an appeal, but they filed it first in the wrong court, and then they didn't attach the right papers to it. Yeah. That case is still pending, but I don't know what relief the Michigan state courts can award in that case, right? Because it just says we want an injunction to stop the counting of absentee ballots because it claimed that observers did not have access to view all of them, particularly video footage of the drop boxes before they were later counted. And then also had that hearsay within hearsay where the poll watcher said she heard from another poll worker that they'd been told by yet other poll workers to change the dates on late ballots. And the judge was like,
nah,
you're kidding me, right? Like that's your evidence. You once heard from a guy whose nephew's brother's cousins once get out of here with that. So that lawsuit is pending. But like I said, the relief it wants is moot right now. The case that matters is also called Donald J. Trump for President versus Jocelyn Benson, but is the federal case, right? That is filed in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Michigan. And that is a request not to certify the results from Wayne County, which is the county of Michigan that includes Detroit. And if those votes are not certified at all, right, if they're just thrown out and zeroed, you know, as with all of these lawsuits, yes, if you exclude the cities in blue states, they become red states.
Yeah. Right? You mean the places where all the people live?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right. Where people live and voted for Joe Biden. So this had the affidavits filed by two canvassing board members. So the canvassing board is split 2-2, two Republicans, two Democrats. And initially, the two Republicans, William Hartman and Monica Palmer, refused to certify the results in Wayne County. Now, their refusal was based on nonsense, right? It was, well, you know, there's all sorts of fraud and we're not convinced and blah, 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 blah. Total BS complaints, right? But then there was public pressure and they came together and they said, okay, we will in fact certify those results after all. Now they have filed affidavits in which they said, well, I was misled. I voted to certify the results, but I thought that the canvassing board was going to do some additional stuff. And so now I want takesies backsies, right? There are no takesies backsies.
There are never takesies backsies. Yeah. I'm actually, you know, surprised that you learn something new every day on this show. Not a lot of takesies backsies in the law.
Backsies. Right. So again, but before I get into the legal significance of this, I want to read to you from the affidavits. Okay. So first, William Hartman's affidavit. This is paragraph 10. During the evening, so first he says, I wanted to raise all these objections about voter fraud. And then paragraph 10, and this is written in, you know, William Hartman, this is an affidavit. So these are the facts of which he has personal knowledge and is testifying under penalty of perjury is true and correct. Quote, during the evening, Wayne County Council and my colleagues on the board continued to discuss irregularities in the canvassing. Mrs. Anderson Davis, that is the lawyer, advised the board that the discrepancies were not a reason to reject the certification. And based on her explicit legal guidance, I was under the belief that I could not exercise my independent judgment in opposition to the certification. Therefore, I voted to certify the results. Right? Then it says, paragraph 11, I was enticed to agree based on the promise that a full and independent audit would take place. I would not have agreed to the certification, but for the promise of an audit. And then if you go all the way down, this is actually missing a page in the court filing. They're going to have to supplement it. It skips from paragraph 13 to the middle of paragraph 17, but it doesn't really matter. Paragraph 18 says, now I voted not to certify, and I still believe this vote should not be certified. I remain opposed to certification of the Wayne County results. So that's what their first witness says, William Hartman. Monica Palmer says the exact same thing. A motion was made to certify the, starting at paragraph 16. A motion was made to certify the vote, and I voted not to certify. The vote to certify failed 2-2. After the vote, my Democratic colleagues chided me and Mr. Hartman for voting not to certify. Mm. Then the public comment, paragraph 18, the public comment continued for over 2 hours, and I felt pressured to continue the meeting without break. And then paragraph 20, after being told by Ms. Anderson Davis, that is the Wayne County lawyer, that I could not use my discretion regarding the anomalies, I believe that I had no choice but to certify the results despite my desire to oppose certification based on the incomplete record. So again, their witnesses in their affidavits say, I voted to certify the results, but I really didn't mean to. And so now you might ask, and this is the capper, you submit affidavits, right, based on the personal recollections and knowledge of these two individuals to get judicial relief. So, Thomas, with your legal training,
okay,
what motion do you think these affidavits are attached to? Right? What relief does the Trump campaign want for which they have filed these affidavits that have said, God. Yeah, I voted to certify, but I want to take it back?
Wow. Takesies backsies motion? I can't even think of what the relief would be.
But you would think it would be some kind of takesies backsies motion. Right? Uh-huh. Like we might be laughing about it.
You know,
it
it'll be the Latin words that mean takesies backsies, but right. Yeah.
Takeo, backseum, right. How surprised would you be on a scale of zero to
Rudy Giuliani level of surprise
this morning that these affidavits are attached to a notice of voluntary dismissal that I'm going to read to you in its entirety right now? Plaintiffs, that is the Trump campaign, voluntarily dismiss this action under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 41A1A. The Wayne County Board of County Canvassers met and declined to certify the results of this presidential election. See attached affidavits.
What?
What is the right answer? Yes, this is attached to. So you are allowed in the rules of federal procedure to withdraw your complaint, right? Mm-hmm. To say, to take that back.
Oh, like, wow. Double you know takes. Yeah. They're trying to form a like a singularity of take backsies.
To say, I you know what? I don't want to go forward with this case anymore, right? And as you might imagine, right, that those motions are liberally granted.
Yeah.
Even if and look, I have opposed once in my career, right, practicing law for almost 25 years now, and once in my career, I have opposed a motion to voluntarily dismiss a case in court, and that was against, it's actually a pending case, someone who I believed was a serial litigator, right, who would bring a case, I would file a motion to dismiss, then they would say, oh, well we're going to voluntarily dismiss this, but then we're going to refile, and I said, and I laid those facts out to the judge, and I said, look, this kind of feels like gamesmanship, and the judge was like, yeah, you know what, like, if it is gamesmanship, that's not a huge it's not a huge burden on you. You know, you got to remove the case. You got to file an answer, but you've already done that work already anyway. And so on the balance, I'm going to let them voluntarily dismiss out their case. Right. So I lost, and I'm not surprised that I lost. That's the standard in the interest of justice. But think about this, and this is what I alluded to at the beginning. What the president's lawyers are saying is, we no longer want any relief from the courts. So there is nothing that this federal court judge can do.
Yeah.
They can say, yeah, okay, great. Yeah, we'll dismiss. Like,
tell me what you want me to say. Yes, no, denied, granted. I think the judge can just send the big Facebook thumbs up button like to the in reply.
You're like, you can. I don't know what that means. I have been refreshing the docket all day, right? While we've been here, because I am dying to figure out what the Michigan court is going to do here. But look, yeah, the judge could issue a minute order, right? That is something that shows up on the docket that just says, because this is ECF number 33, right? This is entry number 33, notice of voluntary dismissal. And the docket and the judge could very easily just enter a minute order that says, notwithstanding the factual inaccuracies contained in number 33, notice of voluntary dismissal, and noting that this court is not agreeing that the Wayne County Board of County Canvassers declined to certify the results of the presidential election, this motion is granted. That's what I would do if I was this judge. And by the way, it's what I think this judge will do.
Well, right? What is and granted?
The notice of voluntary dismissal, and then the case is closed.
Okay, yeah. Case closed. And then will Trump say, yeah, we got what we won?
That's right. And Trump will say, look,
we won. 29, yeah.
But he will have lost because Wayne County
he filed a motion that says, can you agree we lost this one? And then the judge is like, yes, I agree you lost this one. We won!
Yeah. That victory. 100%, this confirms that this is just a stunt because Wayne County has met. They have certified their results. And look, it's a non-trivial argument, right? Like it's not supported by facts. But if that certification was procured under duress, absolutely you could get judicial relief, right? You could get injunctive relief overturning the certification. That's what they filed this complaint to do in the first place. But they want to dismiss it. They're like, all right, it's like Vietnam circa 1973, right? Like declare victory and withdraw. And
as our favorite movie, Fish Called Wanda says, Vietnam was a tie.
Yeah, that is what they have said. And and let's explain this in mathematical terms. Once this notice is entered, right? Once Trump is allowed to voluntarily dismiss out this case, there will now be no case pending in Michigan, which can give him the relief in Wayne County that he wants. The state case is about stopping recounts.
As big of pieces of crap as these people were who are like trying to not certify the results in, curiously, the most racially diverse like county in the state. Anyway, it's all horrible. But like, I wonder if this was intentional to be like, oh man, I meant to not certify, maybe to get Trump off their back. I don't know, because really funny. Oh, the lawyer told me I had to, because, obviously I have to, but I didn't know that I could have not. So, and then they try to do a takes backsies lawsuit. Is it all because of the baby in the White House that we've just been hostages to for 4 years, like that Twilight Zone episode with a kid?
Yes, is the answer to your question, right? Like this is, we have evidence, right? It is widely reported in the news that the Trump campaign contacted Monica Palmer, at least. So that is a very, very, so the first part of what you asked is this all just theater? Yes. And is it all just a temper tantrum from the giant baby in the White House? Yes. The second part is it, plausible that these folks are trying to seek some kind of cover from undue pressure from the giant baby in the White House? And again, we can't prove that part, but we can say it certainly seems plausible.
So that's the last lawsuit, or that there won't be any pending litigation in Michigan. So there's nothing to worry about. Are we all fine? Is everything fine, Andrew?
Well, that was the aperitif to the litigation in Pennsylvania, which has been dominating the news cycle, and in which we had our own intrepid associate, Morgan Stringer, listen to 5 hours of Rudy Giuliani arguing in open court in the Buchvar case. So
you're not going to be sued for that, are you? I mean, you made somebody listen to 5 hours of Rudy Giuliani. Surely there's some employment law that...
I paid her for that.
Yeah, I know. That doesn't make it better. You tortfeasor. Oh, good. I guess I got one in. Andrew's a tortfeasor. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Fundrise. We've heard for years that it's important to have a diversified portfolio. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, that kind of thing. But if you ever looked at the breakdown of the most successful portfolios, you'll typically see a diversified set of real estate. So why isn't it one of the first asset classes you consider when you're looking to diversify? Well, the answer is simple. It hasn't been available to investors like you and I until now, thanks to Fundrise. They make it easy for all investors to diversify by building you a portfolio of institutional quality real estate investments. So whether you're just starting to invest in real estate or looking to add more, our friends at Fundrise have you covered. Here's how. Fundrise is an investing platform that makes investing in high-quality, high-potential real estate as easy as investing in your favorite stock or mutual fund. Whether you're looking to add stable cash flow via dividends or prefer long-term growth through appreciation, Fundrise has you covered. To date, Fundrise manages more than $1 billion in assets for 130,000 investors. And since 2014, the Fundrise platform has averaged 8.7 to 12.4% annual returns, and investors have earned more than $79 million in dividends alone. Fundrise's team of real estate professionals carefully vets and actively manages all their real estate projects. And with their easy-to-use website, you can track your portfolio's performance and watch as properties across the country are acquired, improved, and operated via asset updates. So start building your better portfolio today. Get started at fundrise.com/OA to receive your first 90 days of advisory fees waived. That's FUNDRISE.com/OA to have your first 90 days of advisory fees waived. Fundrise.com/OA. And we are joined by, I'm assuming, a very disgruntled Morgan Stringer. How are you doing, Morgan?
I'm doing all right. How are y'all?
Good. Andrew, are we okay to talk to someone who's obviously suing you for intentional infliction of emotional distress? Is that normal? Can we talk to her? Can we say?
She's by appearing on this show, she has waived all rights in perpetuity throughout the universe. So
I knew this was a trap.
Of course it was. So, Morgan, we just went through the Michigan lawsuit and the absolutely bonkers procedure that happened there today. You have been following the extant lawsuit, parallel lawsuit in Pennsylvania, the Buchvar case, in which Donald Trump is seeking to have Pennsylvania not certify its electors. Why don't you tell us about that lawsuit and tell us about Rudy Giuliani's fantastic oral argument skills.
Okay, well, it was also a very normal and very cool time attending that hearing. So basically what the Pennsylvania lawsuit is it's very weird. So they're claiming, essentially there's two voters, and they are claiming that, you know, basically I'm assuming they are Trump voters, right? And they are saying that when they went to vote, and this is in Lancaster County and then some other rural county up in Pennsylvania. They went to go vote. They, you know, but they forgot to put their ballots into the secret ballot envelope. And then they went ahead and mailed it. But they're saying that their votes were not counted. And so basically what they're trying to do now is say, okay, well, our county did not tell us that we could go and cure our ballots. And the Pennsylvania code says we can't cure our ballots, but then the Pennsylvania Secretary of State has been saying that, you know, you can cure your ballot. And we would have been able to cure our ballots had we lived in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, in those counties. And so they are suing under the theory of equal protection, which is an interesting one, but so they're saying basically...
The remedy they're seeking for equal treatment, though, is don't allow any of these ballots to count?
Yes. Yeah, basically. And so that also the Trump campaign is suing, saying that they're also basically being denied equal protection under that same theory, which there's very clear case law that campaigns can't just allege that. You have to show, especially when it's dealing with a state statute. So in this case, that would be, you know, the Pennsylvania Election Code. And there also was some confusion where the judge was even asking these two, not the two voters directly, but the attorneys, you know, well, why not sue their counties that did not count their vote? You know, that's where your where your dispute lies.
And what was the answer to that?
Well, basically it was, Giuliani responded by saying, well, they can't sue their counties because their counties followed the law.
That seems like not a great admission when you want judicial relief. Am I wrong on that?
Well, they're saying, oh no, these rural counties, they all did great. But, and he even said this in his oral argument, he talked about how, he's talked about how these Democrat-run cities have this tradition of voter fraud. And I'll just go ahead and talk about, I guess, the Giuliani's oral argument, which was completely divorced from his claim, right? So they already acknowledged at the beginning, they said, okay, all we're going to talk about today is this equal protection claim and, you know, this motion to dismiss. And then Giuliani gets up there and just goes on it sounded like I was listening to somebody read out cue drops. Like it was bonkers. He started saying that, you know, these Democrat controlled cities, they have this long tradition of voter fraud. There's no way that this was an accident. And he said that COVID-19, that the pandemic provided cover for Democrats to, you know, perpetuate this scheme all across the country. to elect Joe Biden.
At this point, were the judges wearing those glasses that make it look like your eyes are open while they're actually you're catching a nap underneath? Like, how do they how do they deal with this? Does anyone?
Maybe that's why they wouldn't let video happen.
Oh, I see.
So let's get this straight. The oral argument was over the equal protection count, that which is the sole remaining claim in Trump's first amended complaint that is actually before the court. And the equal protection clause claim, that was the one for which Rudy Giuliani, when asked what level of scrutiny applied, said the normal one. Is that right?
Yes. So this was a literal exchange where the judge said, okay, what level of scrutiny am I applying? And do you think I should apply here? And then Rudy just goes, the normal one. And you can kind of almost hear the sigh in the judge's voice. And he just, Rudy just goes, and then he starts saying, and then the judge is like obviously trying to lead him to an answer, right? You know, like a law school professor would a first year law student. He says, you know, are you saying that I should apply rational scrutiny? And then Rudy Giuliani goes into this tangent, which I did not see, you know, widely reported on, about how it's not rational to, you know, have all this fraud going on. And it's not rational to, you know, not count these guys' votes, but to count everybody else's vote. And it's just like, that is, you know, as listeners will know, that is not at all what rational scrutiny means. It's not, was this action a logical thing that someone would do?
Is Rudy Giuliani a lawyer?
I honestly don't know. I did laugh because I saw on his, as they're trying to amend the complaint, that Rudy Giuliani filed what he called his Second Amendment complaint. Yeah, and I was like, yeah, it's probably about to be a Second Amendment complaint because I'm sure this clerk would like to shoot you because you've been trying to file these motions like five times now. Like, and then they're just, you know, I keep seeing plaintiff will refile. And yeah, it's clear he has no idea what he's doing. I mean, he hasn't entered a federal appearance since I was literally a fetus. So, you know, it's been fun. But yeah, Rudy was going off about binoculars, saying this is another one that I hadn't heard before, that, you know, these poll watchers, these Republican poll watchers, they were pinned into a pen and there was a big fence. And he went off into some weird aside saying that some big company must have gotten a big contract based from the Democrats, you know, to build these fences to keep the Republican poll watchers out. Which now, was a weird aside, but
I have read. Yeah, I was going to say I have read the first amended complaint in this case. This is a hearing on the motion to dismiss that first amended complaint, and those allegations are not in that complaint.
No.
So and that seems like not a great use of your time.
No, it's not. But this is exactly why I have no choice but to stand one of the attorneys for the government, Mark Aronchik, who called Rudy out and just said, you're making despicable claims in a court of law. He said, this is disgraceful. And then he even made the claim. He was like, I don't think Mr. Giuliani has read or even understands, you know, these past cases that have been coming down in Pennsylvania, including from the judge who's presiding, to which, you know, Rudy was like, oh my goodness, you know, how dare you? And then other people were kind of saying, well, I think Aronchik is, which he had a terrible audio connection. I wish he wouldn't have because he was tearing Rudy apart, you know, because Rudy was making these claims that, oh, these poll watchers, they couldn't even see the ballots being counted with binoculars. And, you know, and he started saying the mob might be involved. And it just, I mean, completely crazy.
Wait, I don't know. I think I would have pulled the connection trick, too, if I was a judge. Oh, I'm running, going through a tunnel. You're cutting out, Rudy. And just sent, I'll email like denied or something.
And Aronchik made a good thing. He did a very good thing which I was waiting on somebody to say. He was like, yeah, Giuliani's claiming that the concrete injury to the Trump campaign, because that's essentially why they were asking to dismiss, right? Because in order to survive a motion to dismiss for this, both the campaign and these voters have to show how they in particular were injured, you know, point A to point B by these defendants. And so, you know, just a general allegation of, well, maybe they counted these votes and maybe they didn't count these. That's not good enough.
Yeah. Do we know how many ballots were cured in these counties that they're complaining about?
Well, that's the thing. They don't even allege that these provisional cured ballots were even counted.
Oh, really?
Oh my God. It's absolutely bonkers. And that's why Rudy.
What are we doing here? I don't know how judges don't lose their cool more. I guess that's why they're judges. By the way, sorry to get all political, but like you see these clips of judges dressing down like black defendants, you know, when they're caught with marijuana or something, they do all these weird things. Can we do that with this clown who is wasting everyone's time trying to subvert democracy? Can we dress him down a bit? Can some judges issue some smackdowns on this absolute creep weirdo claiming that the mob is involved? Come on.
That's what I would have liked to see that more, because honestly, if this had happened, I mean, even in state court in Mississippi, a judge would have been like, hold up, I'm sorry, but what the hell are you talking about? You know, because we're here. This is, it's like, you know, sir, this is a Wendy's. It's like, sir, this is a hearing for a motion to dismiss, you know, and like, you are not talking about why. And then Rudy started saying, oh, well, he did kind of get, I mean, not really back on track, but after he was saying, you know, we couldn't even see through binoculars what was happening. And, you know, these ballots could have come from Mickey Mouse. We don't know. He did start saying, you know, well, we have to get past this motion to dismiss because we have so much evidence that there's, you know, fraud all across the country. And I also did like this moment. So towards the end, when the judge was, you know, asking questions, he asked Rudy straight up. He said, well, are you alleging fraud? Because fraud is not alleged in your complaint. And Rudy Giuliani says, yes, we are alleging fraud. And then the judge says, okay, well, you know, you're aware that that has a heightened pleading standard, which it does. Under Rule 9B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, there are heightened standards that you have to pass through to allege how, you know, the fraud impacted you, how it occurred, different things like that. You can't just say, oh, there was fraud.
Yeah, I want to just emphasize that a little bit. Ordinarily, right, as we talk about, you know, how anybody can sue anybody, that is under Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, you can, it is called notice pleading, right? And that is when you see the phrase, on information and belief, Morgan Stringer broke into my house, you know, multiple times, right? I don't have to prove that you did. I have to say, I think you did. And then we go to discovery to gather that information. But when you plead fraud, you must plead the particular fraudulent statements with particularity. You can't say there was a fraud. What kind of fraud? Well, I don't know. When I get discovery, I'll
prove
it.
The whole thing, Your Honor, the whole thing seemed fishy.
So that's what that Morgan is 100% correct in and accurately describing the law. But that's the practical difference, right? The law lets you say, yeah, you know, my back door was I'm pretty sure I closed it when I went to bed, but then it was open. And, you know, there were size 6 footprints. And I, like, you know, the law enables you to draw inferences when you are filing an ordinary tort lawsuit. But when you allege fraud, when you say somebody has lied to you and required you to, you know, and fraudulently induced you to do something, or, you know, other claims that sound in someone making affirmative misrepresentations to you, the law requires you to tell us what those are. And they have not.
And by the way, as we're recording right now, just in, Rudy Giuliani's hair dye is melting off his face. Like all I'm seeing pictures everywhere of this disgusting dye dripping down. This guy is melting. He's literally melting down, having a meltdown.
Yes. And then Sidney Powell, our dear friend, Andrew.
I don't think we can take it. This is too much.
She said Hugo Chavez rigged the vote.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, who has been dead since 2013.
I lack words for this clown car. So what's next in the litigation, Morgan?
Okay, so what's next is, the judge did not rule on the motion to dismiss, which I am very glad that I'm glad that an attorney did speak up. I think it was the attorney for the DNC, basically stood up and kind of gave the judge a little bit of a hard time there and pushed back and was like, you know, time's of the essence. You know, like, this guy just got up here and said all kinds of crazy stuff. And then going back to the fraud thing, when he said, yes, we're alleging fraud, and the judge pointed that out, then Rudy said, oh, no, Your Honor, we're not alleging fraud. So keep that in mind for when Rudy is holding these press conferences saying Hugo Chavez and Cuba and, you know, whatever, Q and everybody else, you know, rig the vote or whatever. So, yeah, just keep that in mind. But yeah, so what's next is essentially Rudy has filed a he eventually, I guess, figured out how to file online. So big moment for him.
Whoa, he can do this on a computer? Wow.
He clearly did not know. And then also to tell you how bad of a lawyer he is also at the end of a hearing. And you'll love this, Thomas. Linda Kearns, who was the attorney who was dismissed, but the judge wanted her there to answer questions. She withdrew from the case, so the judge let her, but he was like, I want you here. She was asking about, you know, what is next in this case and things like that. And the judge was saying, you know, this, and she just says, you know, well, Your Honor, is this all going to be in your order? And then he just responds, yes, Miss Kearns, but you should be writing it down anyway, because that's what lawyers do. They write things down. And then Rudy did not understand that he had to file a motion to amend his complaint. There was a really weird exchange about that where he was just saying, okay, so you're going to grant us our motion to amend. And the judge said, no, I'm not going to say whether I am or I'm not. You can file that motion. And he just, again, it was just not understanding basic things about procedure, to which I'm just like, was a mob that hard to take down?
Yeah. America's mayor, everybody. America's mayor.
I guess I want to conclude the segment with, because the universe hates us, we will be getting the resolution to much of this pretty much right as you're listening to the show, because the courts granted Rudy Giuliani's one-day request for an extension of time, which, again, in any normal case would be routine, right? Like this is moving at breakneck pace and the plaintiff has had three separate sets of lawyers withdraw, you know, which is usually a bad thing. Right?
Now, I'm in such suspense to find out though, what the, you know, whether or not they're going to rule that Chavez rigged the election or not.
Well, here's the thing. Here's what we're waiting for. We will get this at 5 p.m. today. So, like, literally within about an hour from after we finish the show, we will know what Donald Trump, through Rudy Giuliani, is actually asking the court to do. Because right now, I'm 100% serious about this. If they don't file by 5 p.m. today in this court a motion for preliminary injunction, then all of this is just theater, right? Because the injunction is the request to have the court tell the canvassing board to do something, right? And right now, they don't have that. And as Morgan has pointed out, right, like all of these allegations about, like, you know, defects in cures and all of that, I mean, never mind that these were all litigated in the various state court proceedings, right? So when you see Trump is 1-29 in state court proceedings, right? Like those were part of the 29, right? So they want a second bite at the apple for something that state courts have already determined. And as of now, they are not asking the court to do anything. Now, I think they will, right? And I think this is going to be a delightfully ridiculous motion for injunction. That's due Thursday, 5 p.m. Then opposition briefs by defendants are due Friday at 5 p.m. And Rudy Giuliani's reply brief is due Saturday at noon, right? So when I say this litigation is moving at a breakneck pace, that's the fastest I've ever seen for a briefing schedule, right? 24 hours and then 16 hours to file your reply brief. So, you know, we'll know, of course, after the show is recorded, exactly what that looks like. But, you know, I expect the combined brain power of Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell to give us something truly amazing to look forward to.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I have seen, you can imagine, going to law school in Mississippi, I've seen some bonkers hearings. Wild hearings, but this is truly one of the most bonkers ones I've ever seen, where an attorney is just up there like making up random stuff. And again, it's just like, sir, none of this is in your complaint. Like, what are you doing? But yeah, so I mean, I got to give it up to Aronchik, who called him out for it. And I wish more attorneys would do that. And I wish the judge would do it a little bit more. But, you know, I think he's just kind of exasperated at this point.
Yeah. So in conclusion, Morgan, great day of being employed by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, or the greatest day in your employment by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres?
I gotta say, I was enjoying it. I was, but then I was getting angry because I was like, Rudy Giuliani's making 20 grand a day. So that shows
yeah,
I
what
need
are you
to
making,
ask
like
Andrew 15? For a raise.
Yeah, you gotta get up to the 20 grand level.
Sure. All right, this interview is over. We're done.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons, patreon.com/law. Hope you're enjoying the plot against the president. The truth finally revealed. There was a plot against the president. And all the other good stuff. So thank you to greetings from Poland's anarchist jurisdiction. John Washmuth, Citizen Earth Media. Please don't thank me on the show. Okay. Well, I didn't. Enact anti-schlap legislation. Stop Matt and Mercedes. That's pretty good. Adderall the President's Men is good too. I like that.
Oh, that is such a good name.
Game 4D Cure. Gabriel Bodine, I move to have the last 4 years stricken from the record. Yep. That's about as plausible as Rudy's legal arguments. Same thing. Joseph Ritchie and eviction notice at the White House. Yeah. All right. Your turn, Andrew.
Thank you to Joe Johnson, to Angry German, to Keitholomew Splatterson. I hope that's two people that have just merged, but fantastic name. To Timothy Loveridge, Joseph Mudd, without peer review, your theory is just a hypothesis. That is true. To Arizona Blue Balls Climax 2020, which I think they just wanted me to say that. To Dawid, to Napoleon Blown Apart. Good one. Richard Scott and Thomas M. Joyce. Thank you all so much for supporting the show over at patreon.com/law.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE, although I feel like any legal knowledge I had, Andrew, I've lost after listening to Rudy Giuliani try to be a lawyer. I got nothing.
Oh, man. These are oppressive conditions under which to have to think like an actual lawyer, but I have confidence in you. Thomas, police who had probable cause to arrest a man for a series of armed robberies obtained a warrant to arrest him. At 6 a.m., they surreptitiously entered the man's house and, with guns drawn, went to the man's bedroom where they awakened him. Startled, the man asked, "What's going on?" And the officer replied, "We got you now." Another officer immediately asked the man if he had committed a particular robbery, and the man said that he had. The police then informed him that he was under arrest and ordered him to get dressed. Charged with robbery, the man has moved to suppress the use of his statement as evidence. What is the man's best argument for granting his motion? A, the police did not give him the required Miranda warnings.
Oh, yeah.
B, the statement was not voluntary. C, he was not informed that he was under arrest until after he made the statement.
Hmm.
Or D, the police did not have a search warrant authorizing entry into the house.
Oh, this is tough.
Yeah.
I don't know which
one of
those.
But a great one. I love this question.
Well, I think, hold on, I'm going to use what I learned in the last segment. I think you just say fraud, and then you're like, it's fraud. And then like, what? And then you win, right? Oh, you're not answering because we're in test mode. I get it. You'll have to tell me, you know, next episode whether or not I got that right. Okay, that's my answer. Fraud. So, okay, I mean, Miranda warning seems, you know, that's not nothing. So I'm going through this. Okay, so they have a warrant to arrest him. Does a warrant to arrest someone allow you to just go into their house, guns drawn? Probably. And you ask him if he committed a robbery. A, the police did not give him the required Miranda warnings. I think that's good, but also, this is weird. So can you just go and ask somebody like, hey, did you do it? And then, because they already have probable cause. I assume you can't just do that, otherwise it would sort of get around the Miranda stuff all the time. Like, that would be a one weird trick to just be like, well, we haven't technically arrested him yet. Although, I don't know, maybe it is. B, the statement was not voluntary. got guns drawn, you know, saying we've got you now. I mean, that's, it's not a terrible argument. This is gonna be hard. See, he was not informed that he was under arrest until after he made the statement. That I don't think is a good one. I mean, I could be, who knows? This is a tough one, but I don't think C. So I'm gonna go not C is so far all I have. And D, the police did not have a search warrant authorizing entry into the house. I know that when you arrest someone, I think you are then allowed to search the area of the arrest, you know, for like weapons or something. But if you have an arrest warrant, can you just barge into someone's home? I think so. Can't you? Police can do anything in this damn country. Pretty sure you can. So this is tough. I think I'm going to eliminate C and D because they don't seem like the best ones to me. So I'm grasping at all the straws I have. So is it that they didn't give him Miranda warnings or that the statement was not voluntary? I'm struggling because Miranda seems good, but then if they didn't technically arrest him, because then the police then informed him that he was under arrest and ordered him to get dressed. What is the Miranda? How does that exactly go? Because I feel like police can do the thing where they try to talk to you. As Andrew said, they can just be like, hey, how's it going? You want to tell us what blah, blah, blah. All right. This could be way off. I think I'm going to go not voluntary because they arrested him with guns drawn and woke him up, you know, like, and he's startled and they ask him what's going on. I'm not confident in this. I'm between A and B, but I think I'm going to go with B because it was not voluntary. That's all I've got. I haven't been arrested and don't remember the precise order of how everything has to happen with Miranda rights, but I don't know. B is my final answer. Not confident in it at all.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening, everybody. And nothing to worry about. Andrew says it's all fine, even though all this nonsense is happening. It seems like it's all fine because they aren't competent and they
They're
lost
terrible.
By a lot. They lost by a lot.
Yeah, this would be scary if it were closer, but it's not.
All right. Well, thanks for that. I feel better. Have a good weekend, everybody. See you on Tuesday.
He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media LLC. All rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community: Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.